in until that happened was to live in the societies in which they lived, do the best they can, follow Jewish law, and pray to God. Zionism was a rebellion against that, and the reason that overwhelmingly kind of, you know, Jewish religious authorities were initially opposed to Zionism was because it was a movement led by secular people that was a rebellion against Jewish law. But it was also essentially politicizing this religious idea of the connection to the land of Israel. And this is why when Herzl, who, you know, thought that maybe they could try to start a Jewish state somewhere else, right? Basically, he found that the masses of Orthodox Jews in Eastern Europe could only become political Zionists if it was going to connect to their religious association with the land of Israel that they had been steeped in their entire lives. To me, I think that the problem is that Judaism, like all other religions, has many voices and many messages. It's dangerous to try to essentialize it in any way. But there is the notion that human beings are created in the image of God. And so nothing should be elevated above human beings who are considered to have of infinite value. And it seems to me what Zionism has done, what the State of Israel has done, it is that it has led many people in the organized American Jewish community to elevate this state above the absolute value of the human beings who live within this state, more than half of whom are Palestinian, who are also created in the image of God, right? And so that, to me, is an act of idolatry because, you know, Heschel said that there's only one thing that's created in the image of God, is the human being. And to act as if anything else is sacred or sacrosanct is to turn it into an idol and to be practicing idolatry, right? And you see this in this phrase, does Israel have a right to exist? I think the answer, this is something that Yeshayahu Leibovitz, the Israeli philosopher, said, absolutely not. No state has a right to exist. Human beings have rights. States are just instruments. They are instruments for the protection of human life and human flourishing and human dignity. And their legitimacy is entirely based on how good a job they do in protecting the rights and dignity of life of the people. And so when you use the phrase, does Israel have a right to exist, as a way to shut down a conversation about what Israel is doing in slaughtering all of these people, right? You are elevating the state above the human being. And I think this is what Leibovitz and Heschel and others saw as idolatry. And I wonder whether there is a parallel in, to some degree, to what's happening among some white Christians in the United States vis-a-vis Trump in the United States, which is that all of a sudden these people for whom they believe that Christianity is central, right? I'm not an expert on Christianity, but my understanding is that Christianity also has a universal principle about human dignity, regardless of what nation you live in, where you happen to be born, about human dignity, right? But what's happened is this nationalist, ethno-nationalist enterprise means that essentially your notion of Trump and of kind of American nationhood just completely leads you to not care about the human lives that you're going to destroy when you try to start rounding up millions of people in January. And to me, that's analogous to what I see, unfortunately, in certain areas of the Jewish community when we talk about what's happening in Gaza.
As Israel becomes more and more an international symbol of oppression, racism, genocide, isn't this in of itself putting Jews around the world in greater danger?
Yes. Now, to say yes is not to absolve people of their moral responsibility. If you take out your anger against Israel because of the terrible, terrible things that Israel's doing, and you go and you harass or beat up a Jewish person, that doesn't mean that if you take out your hostility towards Israel against a Jewish person, that you are absolved of responsibility. You're not absolved of responsibility. You have a responsibility to make a distinction between your opposition to that state and your opposition to that individual person, just like you have a responsibility, no matter how you feel about the People's Republic of China, not to take out your animosity towards the People's Republic of China on a Chinese-American person, right? But the problem, it seems to me, that we have in fighting against people who conflate Israel and Jews and therefore take out their anger against Israel on Jews is that we're trying to ask them to make a distinction between Israel as a state and Jews as a group of people. But the organized American Jewish community is not making that distinction ourselves so often. So you find that the Jewish organizations are often saying something along the lines of, that being a Zionist or supporting Israel is inherent in being Jewish. First of all, just that statement really doesn't make any sense, because Judaism existed for a long time before Zionism existed, and there have always been significant numbers of Jews, right, for a variety of reasons, who opposed political Zionism in the state of Israel. But it's also just very dangerous because you are making exactly the conflation that we want people who oppose Israel and Zionism not to make. So when the chief rabbi of Israel, of the United Kingdom said a few years ago, he said that Zionism leaps from every page of the Siddur, of the Jewish prayer book. It's a very strange statement given that we've had prayer books since long, long before, you know, Herzl and Pinsker came along in the late 19th century. Then why shouldn't someone write Free Palestine on a Jewish prayer book? You've basically just said it's the equivalent of a political pamphlet for the state of Israel, right? And that's a very, very dangerous thing to do. Look, most of the anti-Semitism that endangers Jews is coming from the ethno-nationalist right. We have data that shows that there's literally data in Belgium, Australia, and the United States, three studies that show in a given week, if Israel kills more Palestinians, there's a rise of reported anti-Semitic incidents, right? So we do see that this does happen, and it seems to me fighting it requires everyone to agree that the state of Israel is one thing and that Jews are another thing, just like Saudi Arabia is one thing and Muslim people in the United States are another thing, right? Or that the People's Republic of China is one thing and Chinese Americans is another thing. But both sides have to do that work. You're not going to be effective in asking anti-Zionists to do that work if you don't affirm that principle yourself.
The narrative that's forged by the political elites and mainstream media sets clear parameters on what is deemed acceptable and what is not. The narrative that prevails today is that Israel is a Western-style democracy that has the right to defend itself. Can you describe to us how dehumanization is being used as a tool of genocide? And what can we do to help shift that narrative on Israel-Palestine?
You know, I've often tried to imagine over the last year what it would be like to be Palestinian, especially Palestinian people who have family in Gaza, and I my mind almost like goes blank. Even though, of course, this is different in many ways from the Shoah, from the Holocaust. Jews, I think, will naturally, when we try to think about the worst thing we can possibly imagine, our minds will naturally go to that. And like many people, grew up with many people who were the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. So I always think about what I saw in those families and the trauma in those families and the way it reverberated from generation to generation. But then I remember that I'm seeing those people, the Holocaust had ended, and they were in a completely different place, right, where they had much greater safety, right? I was seeing them in the United States or in South Africa or Australia or something. So the event had ended. They were far away in a country there where they were not being brutally oppressed, and the world had acknowledged what had happened. And so they were still deeply traumatized, but those conditions allowed the beginnings of some healing. And yet those conditions just don't exist for Palestinians at all, right? There's no, it's ongoing. There's no other place you can go to for most people, and it's not recognized. It's essentially saying, well, what did you do to bring this upon yourself? This dehumanization is so deep that we don't even have a language. We talk frequently about anti-Semitism, but we don't even have a word or a language to talk about bigotry against Palestinians. And I think the reason we don't is because it's so omnipresent that if you had a word for it, it would include almost everybody in Congress, right? Rashida Tlaib would be one of the relatively small numbers of members of Congress who is not an anti-Palestinian bigot, because she's one of the very few who believes that Palestinians and Israeli Jews deserve equality. That's a tiny, tiny percentage of even the Democrats who take that position. It's a very small percentage of the people in mainstream media who take that position, right? It's simply assumed that Palestinians are lesser and deserve less than Israeli Jews. It's so assumed that it's not even, you don't even need to articulate that position. And that, I think, is what has laid the foundation, right? And, you know, this decades and decades of what Said said, the lack of permission to narrate, you know, the work that Maha Nasser has done just about how rare it is to have Palestinians being represented in mainstream publications. I think that The possibilities of the change are because of the way that Palestinians and others who are sympathetic to Palestinians organized on social media and in other places to create alternative voices. I think that's part of the reason you see this generational divide, is because younger people are just getting their media in very different ways. And so they are getting their media in a media that has the potential to be more democratized. But the shift of that media, of that into the mainstream media, is very, very, very slow, and in some ways was set back by October 7th. And we're seeing the consequences of this. I mean, I think this is what Ta-Nehisi Coates' book is about in a lot of ways. It's about the interrelationship between a story in which you were written out of a story and the way in which then your life becomes disposable.
I'd like to speak about, to talk about the Trump administration that's coming in January.
If we have to.
Yes. So in the past, American politicians used to say, no politician ever lost an election by being too pro-Israel. In your recent New York Times article, it was called Democrats Ignored Gaza and Brought Down Their Party. You argue that the 2024 election proved the contrary. That you said in this new era in which supporting Palestinian freedom has become central to what it means to be progressive, the Palestinian exception is not just immoral, it is politically disastrous. Do you think that the Democratic Party leadership will ever conclude that they're continuing to support ethnic cleansing, racism, apartheid, and genocide is not in their self-interest?
I think there's a possibility that that could happen. First of all, I should say that obviously I don't believe that Kamala Harris lost only because of Gaza. There were many factors. Many of them are just kind of mundane and have been discussed a lot. Inflation has been a politically disastrous for governments all around the world in the wake of COVID. But I do think it's hard to explain how poorly she did among young voters in particular, how much more poorly she did than Joe Biden, despite the fact that, you know, evidently her TikTok game was very good. And actually, she did surprisingly well among older and white voters. That's not where she saw the drop-off. There you see, because it's obviously younger voters who had a much, much more sympathy for Palestinians than older voters. The Democratic Party's challenge is that American politics is very deeply corrupt. And there's a deep corruption in the way we fund our campaigns. And so if you're the kind of Democrat, and Joe Biden was this kind of Democrat par excellence, who can only fund their campaign by going to very big donors, those donors are going to push you in a position, a place on Israel, but not just on Israel, also on regulation of Wall Street, regulation of fossil fuels, healthcare, you know, all of these things that is going to lead you to be out of touch, that's going to lead you to not inspire the Democratic Party base, and it's also actually going to leave you vulnerable to the fake populism of Trump and the right, in which people will use this anti-corporate rhetoric on the right. But there's an opportunity there because the Democrats have squandered that. And Trump even used it a little bit on Gaza and Lebanon, basically saying, I'm going to end these wars with some success.
So, and a lot of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans went for it. And now they're saying, we've been played.
Right. What a shocker. Donald Trump lied. But I think if you have a Democratic candidate who can excite people, who can build a movement in different ways, Barack Obama did that and Bernie Sanders did that. That person can raise enough money through small donations by exciting people that they won't need to be so reliant on large donors. And that can give them the freedom to say things on Palestinian freedom, but also on a whole range of issues that are much, much more popular and that I think could potentially really excite younger voters, excite other voters who are alienated from the Democrats, and even win back some of those voters who have drifted into the Republican column. So the key thing to me, it seems to me, is what kind of campaign and candidate you have and who is funding it.
For more than a year now, we have seen that Joe Biden has not wavered in his material support as Israel conducts its genocide. We can expect that support to continue under the Trump administration. Since October 7th, Trump has urged Prime Minister Netanyahu to finish the job, so-called. He said, do what you have to do. On the campaign trail, Trump said, we're going to do a lot for Israel. And when Trump won, his friend Netanyahu said he is the best friend that Israel has ever had in the White House. This Trump finished the job comment, do you think that ethnic cleansing is part of that job? And will this increase the instability in the region? Do you think that Trump in office will speed up Israel's endgame of what I have been calling the out-of-state solution, not the two-state or one-state, emptying Gaza of Palestinians and continuing its ethnic cleansing? And
yes. We know from reporting that Netanyahu was urging Western leaders to try to pressure the Egypt in the early days of the war to open the borders, right? So there would be a mass exodus of Palestinians. And obviously, there's no reason whatsoever to believe they ever would be allowed to return. We know that that's what, you know, Israeli people in the Israeli government were talking about that. The Egypt held the line and refused this. But I think it's completely plausible to imagine that the Trump administration, maybe even with the support of some in the Gulf, who have a lot of leverage over Egypt because it's very much in debt and relies a lot on the Gulf countries, will renew that effort and push very hard. And so, yes, to me, when I think about Israeli strategy and what happened on October 7th, there was no mainstream political leadership in Israel that supported Palestinians having their own state. There's just that position doesn't exist in mainstream Israeli politics. Obviously, there's no mainstream Israeli view that says that Palestinians should have equality alongside Israeli Jews in one state. The mainstream position, the moderate position, like Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, was Palestinians are going to live under brutal oppression, and we're going to manage that oppression through a process of carrots and sticks, right? If maybe they'll get a little few more permits to travel across if there's no violence, and if there is, we'll come down on the very hard. Bezalel Smotrich and the people on the Israeli right had a different view. They said, you can't manage this situation. We're not going to give them their own country. We're not going to give them equality, but we can't manage this oppression because they are going to resist. And if they resist, we're going to have to basically force them out. Smotrich wrote this thing called the Decisive Plan in 2017. He said, basically, if Palestinians don't accept their subjugation, they have to leave, essentially, right? And what October 7th showed was that the management process does not work. You can't do it. You can't manage millions of people who you deny the most basic human rights to. And that is why I think the Smotrich position has moved towards center stage. That idea that basically you're going to solve the Palestinian problem, you could call this the American solution, right? How did America solve these problems in the 19th century? Did we divide the country along the Mississippi River in a two-state solution? No, we did not. It took generations, but ultimately we so destroyed the native population that they were not a political threat. They couldn't act politically anymore. And so, you know, people say, well, you can't do in the 21st century what you did in the 19th century. We don't know that. Is that the case? That in some ways is the macro question. Can you or not, in a world of Donald Trump and Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and climate change, and the norms that restrain states are not growing stronger. They're growing weaker. And that seems to me the question for the entire planet, in some ways, that is on the line here. Because if you can do it to Palestinians, I think you can do it. There are many other leaders around the world. I'm sure Narendra Modi is looking at what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing. Gosh, I was like, we have a lot of Muslims in India. Maybe that we could solve our problem with Muslims in India this way, too, and many, many other places. It would be bad enough if it were just happening to Palestinians and it didn't have any of the repercussions. But the truth is the repercussions, I think, for the entire world of this being able to actually be accomplished, which it could be accomplished, are just catastrophic.
I'd like to, in the last few minutes, talk about the Trump's cabinet lineup, which includes Marco Rubio as Secretary of State and Elise Stefanik as the ambassador to the United Nations.
Yeah. So they're not sending us their best.
And Mike Huckabee, my God, ambassador to Israel.
Yeah.
This morning, actually, in an article in the Haaretz, Israeli journalist Gideon Levy said, this should not be labeled friends of Israel. They should be labeled as the worst of its enemies. Mm-hmm. The new people in charge of the U.S.'s foreign policy are friends of apartheid, occupation, the settlements, and war. These are president-shifting appointments spell more doom for the region and its people. Based on Trump's appointments, it's becoming clear that the annexation and Greater Israel could be at the forefront of any political agenda. A river to sea, Israel, is on Trump's horizon. And reinforcing that is Netanyahu's appointment of none other than Kahanist Yeshil Leiter as the new Israeli ambassador to Israel.
Yeah.
So these disgusting appointments are, I want to say, a slap in the face, but it's more like a giant middle finger to the rule of international and human rights. And wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. This fanatical support for Israel that you see in the Trump administration is not it's not coincidental. Israel is not, in a lot of ways, the way Israel functions in American politics is not really as a foreign country exactly. It's more like a proxy debate about the nature of the United States, because Israel is, for many people in the Republican Party, and not only the Republican Party, you see for people in Europe too, right, and for people in India, the shining model for them of a high-tech, economically dynamic, supremacist, ethno-nationalist political system, which is what they want in their own country. So in a way, the way they're responding to Israel is they want to support Israel as part of their effort to make America more like that. What does Trump want? Trump wants an America that kind of has clear legal hierarchies between people of different racial, religious, ethnic groups. He wants an immigration policy that maintains our demographic majority. All of these things. But I think this is also why the pro-Israel position in the Democratic Party, or what was, you know, historically often been called the progressive except Palestine position, why it's weakening and even potentially crumbling. Because Mike Huckabee is a very bad spokesperson if you're trying to maintain support for Israel inside a Democratic Party, because his vision of America is so fundamentally antithetical. And I think more progressive-minded people in the United States also understand that because that the people who in America who are most supportive of Israel are also the people who are trying to turn America into a country based on legal supremacy in a struggle that is really an existential struggle for us here in the United States. And that's why I think we're seeing this gradual, clear alignment. Basically, there are people who support ethno-nationalism here and there, and there are people who oppose ethno-nationalism here and there. And I think that's where the hope is, that maybe people who oppose it here and there ultimately will be able to gain the upper hand in the Democratic Party.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You were just listening to Peter Beinart on protests, Zionism, and Gaza. He spoke at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in mid-November. Peter Beinart is professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. He's a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times and editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Francesca Albanese, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Peter Beinart on Protest, Zionism, and Gaza, and for Rashid Khaledi's book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sud Jolly of the Media Education Foundation and to Michelle Moshebek of Olive Branch Books. Jovich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Shive of Ireland. She's singing Rifat al-Arir's poem, If I Must Die. Rifat al-Arir was a noted Palestinian writer, poet, and professor. He was killed by Israel in Gaza on December 6, 2023.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live nationwide, offering a confidential multilingual service 24/7 to connect human trafficking victims and survivors with social and emergency services. We welcome calls if you have tips, concerns, or questions about human trafficking in your community. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call the hotline now at 1-833-900-1010.
You're listening to